Welcome to the Law of Raspberry Jam. We are back, and in this episode, we're going to talk about how large teams can work. It's more than just limiting whip. Hey, Victor.
Hey, Esther.
It's been a really long time.
It has.
But we came across a topic that got us both going and thinking.
Yeah, in a bit different directions, which means a good ground for conversation.
Yeah, yeah, indeed.
It was the article. So a while back there was this LinkedIn posted about the size of teams and how teams can be larger than what we historically have expressed as the limits.
Yeah, I think I saw your blog post about that, saying don't be afraid of big teams. And that mm-hmm. led me to some other sources. And on one hand, I think it's sort of an intriguing idea that, you know, having a larger team can reduce dependencies, which certainly makes sense to me. And it kind of ignores a ton of research.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about that. And I want to explore a little bit more on the research. But first, maybe we can talk a little bit about what the post says more than just reducing the dependencies. What are the pros and what are the cons?
Well, I think that was the major benefit was, you know, if you have a large product, that it's not feasible to have all the skills on one team, then the answer is to have a much bigger team so you reduce dependencies. And you can succeed at this by limiting WIP, because then they can get work completed fast.
And that's the aspect that resonated with me in the article, or in the notes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking back to this example where I had encountered a large team for the first time that was with 25 people, and we made it work and worked really, really nicely. And limiting WIP was one important part of it. And then we started having our conversation, and you raised your prompts and explored many aspects. And I noticed that I was taking a lot of things for granted, or they were just like, there was a whole body of implicit knowledge,
yeah.
Things we did, but we didn't think about that we did them. And they were, I would say, larger contributing factors to the fact that the team worked.
Yeah, I mean, I think limiting WIP is in general a good thing. I don't think it's sufficient to have a team function well, or even deliver more rapidly. I mean, they need feedback in order to make that happen. So I was intrigued about your experience, and I wanted to delve into what was going on for that team that enabled it to be so effective.
Yeah. So when I read the post and listened to the episode where they talked about large teams, what came to mind was specifically the way that tasks were distributed.
Mm-hmm.
There was this big team with 25 people, and the product manager would set monthly goals, and there were 4 monthly goals. And then the group would divide into smaller groups every week, and they would the groups would self-organize based on the people who needed to collaborate to achieve those goals.
Aha! So it wasn't necessarily 25 people all working together all the time.
Definitely not.
So there were self-organizing groups within that. And how big were those groups?
They were small, quite small. We would have, I think the largest group might be somewhere about 8 people, mm. and the smallest groups would be somewhere around 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that differed from week to week.
Sure.
There was also another thing. So when you started asking me questions like this, another thing became apparent to me, which was there was no real competition for people's focus. They didn't have any legacy from previous teams that they had worked in, previous technologies that they had to maintain. So it wasn't just the fact of like, oh, let's limit the amount of goals we're trying to tackle. It was also they never had to worry about having other priorities coming from the side. So the limit WIP as an official party tagline, absolutely, but also no legacy to, mm-hmm. to own was also a part of like, and you can't just say, oh, let's limit WIP, because stuff like that like creeps onto you, ownership creep. So yeah, that was another.
They didn't have context switching.
Yeah,
that was really limited. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was really curious when you described your successful 25-person team, because one of the things that the research shows about teams is that one of the ways that they become effective is because they know how to work together. They figure out how the people on a particular team figure out how to take advantage of their strengths and compensate for, you know, perhaps weaknesses, and they develop some ability to work together and trust in working together. So it's like continuous mutual help, which mm-hmm. requires a level of trust. And the research always talks about that happening in a fairly small group of people.
It's really hard to, this was a few years ago, so I don't remember everything, mm-hmm. but there were some people who had worked together prior to entering this team or a group or mm-hmm. a large product that they were working on. So they knew each other. And there were some more stable collaborations that would happen from mm-hmm. week to week. So you would see a couple of back-end developers, they would frequently work together, and then there was one who was the lead developer. He would be one person who was more like a bee jumping across mm-hmm. the different areas. Yeah, so there were, and then you had designers, because there were quite a lot of designers and mm-hmm. artists, and they would work more together than in other constellations, and they had worked in these constellations before.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a high degree of people knowing each other. And getting to know each other across this took time. It happened over time. And a part of that is also how the product manager worked with ensuring that people got to know each other across groups.
Sure.
So he treated the team was the entire group of 25 people. After works or social activities, all these gatherings were not happening in the small groups. They happened as a large group, or they didn't happen at all.
Mm-hmm. So that's really interesting, because what that implies for me is that the container for trust and the ability to work together and the knowledge to be able to communicate with each other and to relate to each other as humans, not just task doers, existed at that larger container, which enabled the formation and reformation of the what you would call constellations. I've also read those groups called described as pods. So some people call them constellations, pods, but that because they had that larger container of what's the word I'm searching for? There's got to be a word that contains, you know, some level of trust and some level of social connection and some level of knowing what people know and what they can do, but. Anyway, that is what enabled those ephemeral teams, some of them longer lasting than others, or pods or constellations, to form and reform.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I also think there's this thing, I followed this team for 6 months,
mm-hmm.
right? And when I say that this large team functioned well, which I think they did, was that just because everything was new? There was no legacy. They hadn't encountered any challenges so far. Was that because it was actually successful? Like, what would have, if I would have returned 2 years later, would it still have been that way? Like, did the product become more successful than other products? So there's also this part with what is the expectation? Well, my expectation going into this was that this would never work. And we worked really hard in getting creating this ability within the larger group and the smaller groups to collaborate well. And we got that working. And so when some people say something like, oh yeah, large teams work, what are they actually referring? Like, what is it that they say when this works well? So I'm doing for, because it's a podcast, you can't see, but I'm doing these air brackets here. But yeah, so like, so what does high performance large team mean? Do we have different a different standard for a large high performing team than a small high performing team? And I would assume we do.
Well, I think the assumption of those the podcasts that we listened to that were talking about large teams is that they can deliver more quickly because they aren't hampered by dependencies. So delivering product more quickly seems to be one potential measure of success. No, but going back to what you said, if you what would it be like if you went back 2 years later? I expect it would be different in all sorts of ways. You know, maybe they would be even more effective. Maybe they're working on a completely different product. You know, maybe people have moved around. But I think what's super important about the example that you talk about is how much attention was given to the social aspects of making that larger group of 25 cohesive, as well as making the constellations or the pods functional. And part of that, I suspect, was the way they handle goals.
So that was, and there were other things that we were doing. So the way we handled goals was the product manager would set these goals on a monthly and a 3 monthly basis. You know, here's where we're heading in 3 months. We need to be able to do this. Have a working prototype where the user can do XYZ. Okay, cool. And so for that to happen, we need these three features or capabilities there. And then they gathered everyone on a monthly basis and looked at if this is the capabilities that need to happen this month, what are the small steps we need to take towards this this week? And then he would leave and come back an hour later, and the group would get to present. This is the backlog. And there was a constraint there on this, the groups we set today are only going to exist for a week. So whatever backlog you create has to be able to be completed within that time. So the implicit knowledge, like, so limiting WIP, absolutely. But then we had a group of people who knew how to break down work. And that is something that just limiting WIP doesn't teach you how to do. What do you limit WIP around? Which is a question you asked me aside from today. So what do you limit, and how do you know how to limit it, and how do you know how to break down work, and how do you know how much you can do? And they didn't do any estimations either. So there wasn't like, oh, let's look at story points. So there was a whole body of knowledge around how to break down work and how to plan your work and how to take it on.
Yeah, that's you know, that's an easy assumption to fall into, particularly if you've been working in, you know, thin slices for a long time, or you know, you've done some kind of you know, work where you have to figure out how to deliver incrementally. But that is not a universally understood skill.
And then another thing that comes on to limiting WIP is something I stumbled across when I was reading the book Accelerate recently, where they talk about in their research, they see that WIP limits by themselves are not a strong indicator, or they don't predict delivery performance. Not by themselves, but what you need is a visual system and feedback loops. So you need a lot of feedback loops, and that's also something we did, and we invested a lot of time into making happen. So we would have daily stand-ups with these 25 peoples. And this daily stand-up was early on, the first few days, it took hours. And then we got it down to 10 minutes. So even though we were 25 people, we would get it down to 10, 20 minutes at most when there were difficult conversations. And we created this big, we had this big wall. So first of all, we had a wall. Second of all, we were allowed to use it. Third, we could visualize our work. The work was broken down in a way that aligned with the goal, and it was possible to visualize this, and people cared about updating the status of their own work for their own sake. So these are things we took for granted, but they've had a huge impact.
Right, and I imagine that someone, even who wasn't on that particular team, could have walked in there and looked at the board and had a sense of where things were. With a few basic questions about, you know, what's the encoding or something about that. Unlike Jira.
Yeah, absolutely. So they set up goals. They set up a backstory to why these goals were important. Mm-hmm. They indicated working groups this week. There was a lot of information there.
You know, and that reminds me of another principle that comes out of research that has a lot to do with motivation on teams, which is one of those things that helps people move forward, is like when you achieve a goal, when you can accomplish something, that tends to be highly motivating. So that was also built in to what they were working on.
Yeah.
I don't know if the people designed this knew all this stuff or intuitively knew it or just, you know, got lucky.
I think there's a bit of all of the above.
Yeah, sure.
Some things were intuitive to the product manager's style.
Sure.
Some things were lucky. And then we also, there was a small leadership team around this. Mm-hmm. So there was a lead developer, there was the product manager, there was myself, there was the lead designer. And we got together on a daily basis, and we looked at, and they would talk about what are they hearing and seeing. So the people mm-hmm. in this group were also people working in the small pods, and they would see and know exactly where all the impediments were, and we would talk about them. So what's up? What's happening? Well, we're struggling with this technology, or we need this license, or we're not getting this thing to work, etc., etc. We need to bring in this knowledge. So can someone from another team come and teach us how to do this? And we would work with those things on a daily basis outside of this.
So there was a group of people who were really dedicated to enabling and enhancing the ability of that group to function. And they were Absolutely. Like maybe just they were up on a balcony just a little ways so they could see the whole pattern rather than just completely being in the day to day. Like they had enough knowledge of that to understand what the issues and struggles and frictions might be, but they also could take a step up and kind of see overall, here's what's happening.
And again, with the focus, these people were working in this team or this with this product, and they were entirely dedicated to that. So mm-hmm. there wasn't any competition for their focus in other areas, right. which you sometimes see with people adopting popular models where you're a manager for five teams or for people in five teams, and so you have to attend all of those meetings. That didn't happen here. They were dedicated to this context.
Although five teams could add up to 25 people depending on how you're doing things, but if they're, you know, if they're treated as little silos, then it does add some
yes.
additional time in investment in that.
Yeah.
So when we were talking about doing this episode, we, you know, we both looked at some various bits of research, and the research on team size, you know, that led us to things like saying 7 ± 2 or no bigger than 2 pizzas and all of this sort of rule of thumb guidance is actually based in pretty deep research that's been going on for years. And when I hear you talk about this team, to me, it doesn't feel like it necessarily contradicts that research. because the constellations where the work was actually getting done were pretty small.
Yeah.
They were in line with what the research says is a reasonable size for highly interdependent collaborative work.
And I think if you're someone who's listening in on this and you've heard someone else say like, oh, big teams are great and you should just do it and just put them in a room. Yeah, absolutely. That might work. But there's a lot of work to make that happen. It's not just like put them together and limit WIP.
There's some non-zero chance that that would work. But I think you can make your odds much better if you pay attention to, you know, the social aspects of it, creating that larger container of trust that enables people to form and reform these smaller constellations without a lot of friction.
Yeah. And that brings us to something else we talked a little bit about, which was the team's composition of competencies or skills. So how do you know that the group of people you have the skill set required to complete their work? So it's having a bigger pool of people makes it more likely, possibly. But if the work you're trying to do, if the problem you're trying to solve requires a lot of different people and you are gathering just a group of specialists, then that big group is not only going to be more difficult to help function, it's actually going to be even more you're going to not only get zero positive effects, you're going to get all the negative effects of being a large group of people, because they can't complement each other's skill sets when they have the same skill set. In this case, there was five different competencies among these 25 people. And they needed each other. Mm-hmm. So that was also something that was designed very intentionally. Who do we need in this team to achieve our goal? So the making part, they knew how to make the product that they were making.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I must admit that my, my first sort of reflexive response to these articles about, just have a big team and limit WIP was, well, how would we describe my initial reflective response? Like, okay, let's not go there. But I was.
I think it was
skeptical.
Thoughtful skepticism.
Yes.
Well, thoughtful skepticism.
Thoughtful skepticism. You know, I would say now that I think, I don't know what the correct sociological term is for a group of 25 that self-organizes into smaller pods to do work, but I think it's actually pretty possible, and I think it takes a lot more work than just, you know, saying, okay, we're going to have a big team and limit WIP.
Yeah, but to your point, it's possible to have a large container around a container around a big group of people. But in order for that to function well, whether you do it explicitly or not, they are going to break out into smaller pods. And so what we spent our time doing was making it a deliberate decision. So we need to achieve this goal. Who should work together in order for that? If you don't do it, you're going to get these exclusive subgroups that are not optimized for the task at hand.
Right. This has been a phenomena that's been researched too, that when you get a larger group of people together to try to work on something, no matter what the nature of the work, they will break down into smaller groups. And it might be around, who's been friends longest, or, you know, who is the same, likes to go to lunch at the same place, or, you know, whatever that is actually irrelevant to the work. Right. And so without the intention, you're probably still going to get subgroups, but they may not be at all fit for function in terms of delivering product.
Yeah. So I had a bit of a roller coaster. So first, before I had the team, I worked with the team. My impression was, oh, big teams are bad. I've worked with large teams. I've never made it work. Then I come here and it changes my, it changes my opinion about it. Like large teams can work. And I didn't really think about the contributing factors and how it was actually research that we used. And then when I read the post and listened to the pod, first I was a little bit, not that skeptical, a little bit, and then when I read the post, I was convinced, like, oh yeah, I agree with this. It's just Limit Whip, because a lot of the things we did was implicit. And then when we had the conversation, I was like, ah, no, it's not just Limiting Whip. Ooh, we did so many things. So I'm back to, yeah, large teams can work, but it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
But it's
Well,
worth it if you do it properly. It's worth it
yeah,
if you need it.
absolutely. I mean, and I think in some ways it's the same thing with small teams. It's like a lot of people haven't looked at the research, and their experience of team may be from sports or something, who knows what. But I have seen lots of teams in organizations where, they just take, a handful of people and throw them together at a problem and think that's going to work. Sometimes it will, but you can certainly make your chances better if you look at what the research tells us about how to create the conditions for teams. And I think the same thing is true for a large team. A team of 25. I wish we had a different word for that, because I think team gets used in so many ways that it just confuses the heck out of people. But I think you can have a group of 25 people functioning together beautifully. But just like with a small team, you have to create the conditions where that behavior can emerge, because behavior is always an emergent property of the people in their environment.
So there's this last thing. There's this, and so the last thing, like that I can bring up that our conversations and exploration opened my eyes for was there was this new piece of research coming out from Burgess, and I think I'm pronouncing his name correct, and Robin Dunbar, about large teams, and they take a sociophysics approach to it, where they look at, like, can we through mathematics and physics predict at what team size, at what size a team will essentially decompose. And they talked about three things, and that are the contributing or the leading indicators. And they talked about the seed promise, which is like how motivating and compelling is the goal. And a part of that, I think, Richard Hackman
Yeah,
has.
that's been that research has been around for a long time.
And so the second part is contention. So how much competition is there for cognitive energy? So in this case, the seed promise, like, people were really motivated about this. This was innovation, cutting edge, something that hadn't been done, and it was exclusive to be a part of this team, in terms of the goal. And then in terms of contention, then, so how much competition was there? Well, there was none. Like, this wasn't really designed. This was just emergent. And then the third part was is what they called metaphorical temperature, which I think of as entropy. And there was very limited entropy potential. So there were few layers of management. There were few specialized leadership roles. There were few avenues. Like, there was this one main information avenue, and everyone got the same information. So it wasn't really possible for permutations of understandings to happen. And so they also had that. And this wasn't like intentional. This was, to your point, like a part of this was just luck. So these things in normal organizations, you usually don't have that. You usually have much more entropy potential in leadership and in information distribution channels. You have much more competition for your focus, and you have competing priorities that you might agree with, or none that you agree with, and therefore you have competing.
So that paper that you just mentioned by Burgess and Dunbar, it's fascinating to hear you talk about it. It was a slog to try to read it. It was not an easy read.
No.
So if you're thinking about following up on the research, just be prepared. That's not an easy one.
Yeah.
So thank you for reading it.
Yeah, well, so I might be writing a simplified version of it, about it, like my understanding of it. I might also have gotten parts of it wrong. I just hope I got most parts of it right. But yeah, so like just to summarize what we talked about so far, beyond limiting WIP, what made this large team function was knowing how to limit WIP, knowing how to break down work, knowing how to visualize work, knowing how to self-organize, wanting to self-organize, wanting to be a part of this team.
Having a compelling goal.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, that's kind of essential. Having a compelling goal, having a container of trust and social connection that enabled people to not have a whole bunch of time spent, you know, getting to know each other and figuring out how to work with each other, right?
Yeah. Knowing each other enough before you join the team.
Yep.
At least have a critical mass to each other.
Yep. Attention to enabling the team, attention to creating shared knowledge and maintaining shared knowledge, attention to removing obstacles. Yeah.
Having managers that knew the work that needed to be done and did it.
Yeah.
Not having legacy or like a heritage of work from other areas.
So not having context switching.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of the research applies.
Yeah. So the next time you hear someone say limit WIP, it is
limit
one
whip.
Aspect that's important, but there is a few more.
Quite a few more.
Okay. Yeah, so I really enjoyed having these conversations. They really helped me get a better understanding of why this team was so successful. And they also give me more of a recipe of things to do more deliberately and the next time I work with large teams.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed the conversations too. It was really fun to be back together making an episode. And I'm glad this topic came up and gave us a reason to do a podcast. It was a compelling goal for us.
Yeah. And as always, we're super curious. So if you're listening to this and you have experiences with large teams, whether they're good or bad, desirable, undesirable, you know, feel free to let us know. We'd love to hear from you and your experiences.
Absolutely.
All right. That's it for this time. See you later.
Yep. See you next time.